Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jim Husson. I'm Boston College's Senior Vice President for University Advancement. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Beacon Leadership Conversations. This is our opportunity to invite you, our alumni, parents, and friends, into a dialogue with some of Boston College's most consequential leaders. That certainly describes my guest today, David Quigley, BC's Provost and Dean of Faculties. Before I invite David to join us and before I introduce him to you, let me just say a few words about the call today. We're joined today by more than 500 alumni, parents, and friends from around the world. And we're very excited that you chose to join us today. We're trying very hard to find new and different ways to keep you engaged with BC. This is just one of those opportunities, and I hope that you find it to be worth your time. We'll talk until about 1 o'clock. And the one thing that I would mention as we start is that even though this is a webinar and I can't see you, we're going to try very hard to keep this interactive. I can feel your presence with us today. And so my hope is that you'll use the Q&A, which you should see as a button on your screen, to pose questions that you might like us to ask of David as we move along in the conversation. I'll pose some questions to get us started during about the first half hour. And then after that, I'll ask questions that are coming from you. Now, I won't be able to ask every question that comes in with 500 people on the call, but I'll do my best to ask questions that are broadly representative of what seems to be on your minds. Let me say a word about my friend David Quigley before I invite him to join us. David, as I mentioned, is Boston College's Provost and Dean of Faculties. He joined the Boston College community in 1998 after receiving his bachelor's degree from Amherst College and his master's and PhD from NYU. When he joined us in 1998, he joined as a member of the History Department. And then in 2008, David was promoted to the position of Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, BC's oldest and largest school. And David took that role on at a time that I think was very important for Boston College as we were moving into the Light the World campaign. David played a key role in the planning and execution of that campaign along with our president, Father Leahy. In 2014, David was promoted to his current role as Provost and Dean of Faculties, a role in which he leads all of the schools and faculty, as well as the Office of Admissions. David is somebody who I think I can say is considered to be one of the most innovative and thoughtful academic leaders in higher education. Here at BC, he played a key role in the planning that led to Stokes Hall, BC's first major new academic building for the humanities in more than half a century. In 2015, David led a team of deans and faculty in a process that led to significant changes in BC's core curriculum. And David did that in a pretty interesting way. He and his colleagues turned to the private sector for insight, leading a design thinking process that resulted in the core renewal, a series of interdisciplinary team-taught classes focused on complex problems and enduring questions. And these are classes that have been widely praised, not just at BC, but by our students for whom they're very popular, but they're really considered to be a model in the profession. But that's enough about David for me. Let me invite my friend to come on the call. David, are you with us?
Here I am, Jim.
Hi, David, how are you?
Great to see you, doing all right.
It's good to see you too. Here in Arlington, you must be in Wall House, is that right?
I am on the south side of the Chestnut Hill campus, just across Beacon Street from the main campus.
That's great. Well, I'm gonna try not to lose bandwidth with you today. I'm fighting for that with my daughter, who's a BC junior and who is in a BC class right now. So it seems appropriate to be talking to you as we speak. David, why don't we just kick off with, let me ask a question about your role. I said a few words about you in terms of your basic bio, but I think people would love to hear in your own words, what's a typical, you know, week in the life of the provost at Boston College? Can you give us a sense of your work on a day-to-day basis at BC?
Sure, and what a day or a week in my life over the last month or two is in some ways categorically different from what it had been previously. The provost, it turns out, is considered essential personnel, so I've been in Beacon, in Wall House over here on the main campus for pretty much every weekday since, and some weekend days since the middle of March. It's a bit of a ghost town on campus. We have a couple hundred students still on upper campus, and some of our essential personnel working around campus, making this place hum. But much of my work has been done, as I imagine just about everybody on this call has moved virtual over the last month. As chief academic officer, I work very closely with the deans and the vice provosts, making sure that the current academic operation of the university continues to run as smoothly as possible while planning for the future. Typically, that is on a longer time horizon. A good deal of the planning right now is for summer, fall, and the next academic year. And I'm sure in the questions later in the hour, we'll talk about some of that. It's a wonderful job in my mind, partly because it is just so varied, working just if you think of our eight schools, the Morrissey College, the Carroll School, we've got Cannell, Lynch, Law, Social Work, Theology Ministry, Woods, across the eight units, undergrad and grad, the full diversity of knowledge and disciplines. It is one of the reasons I love history as a discipline, is pursuing the past. I'm a 19th century U.S. historian with a specialty in the history of New York City. The full variousness of past worlds are one of the things that always attracted me to historical study, and one of the things that I always have found, and especially at this moment, especially enlivening and engaging about university administration work, is just how diverse and variegated the worlds of a finance department and a nursing school and an English department might be. So working constantly across this year, trying to keep up with planning for courses in the fall, with faculty hiring that we're wrapping up this past year's cycle, adjusting in this very new age to what we can plan for next year, and thinking constantly about how we can best serve our students, those who we are training to be leaders that the world desperately needs in the future, and thinking about in this particular moment, how do we deploy technologies and a range of other resources to allow our students and faculty to engage and allow high quality teaching and learning to continue.
David, we'll get to some of the questions around this moment in time in a bit. I'm just curious, as a historian, you know, you came here as a member of the history department. Was there a point in time when you felt that your path would lead to academic leadership, into leadership roles? Was, you know, would the David Quigley of 1998 be surprised to know that the David Quigley of 2020 is a provost?
That's a great question. I don't think anyone ever is gunning for the provostship. And if you ever meet someone who is, whose life ambition is to serve as provost, I'd ask some serious questions at that point. I think that one of the early indications that I found the possibility of university administration, at least an intriguing possibility, was early on engagements at the history department level and thinking about curricular reform. How could we take the structure of the major and play around with it to do better by our students? I quickly started working with partners over in the law school on some Fulbright programs for international scholars. I was part of the design team with Dean Andy Boynton that put together the Portico program back almost 15 years ago in the Carroll School. Given that between Amherst College and NYU, I had spent several years teaching in the New York City public schools. I regularly partnered with colleagues over in the Lynch School of Education, now Human Development, and was always interested in those kind of cross-school and cross-departmental connections. So I think in those early years, I was open to the possibilities of what one could do more broadly. Going back to my experience teaching in Brooklyn in the late 80s and early 90s, I continue to carry with me to this day this sense that if I was ever going to be in administration, I would need to keep a foot in the classroom. So I teach at least one course every year, which when I do that, I'm not on the in the classroom this semester, but I taught an undergraduate first year course in the fall. It's always the most exhausting but also energizing work at the same time. It keeps me with a better sense of what your daughter Anna and other students are experiencing in the BC classroom. Last thing that I'd say on that point is in my first 10 years on campus, I had the pleasure of working and getting to know some really remarkable people who had spent a good deal of time in academic administration. And the one who comes to mind right away is Father Neenan, Bill Neenan, and what he meant in the economics department as Dean of Arts and Sciences, and then as, at that time, academic vice president, now what we call the provostship. Father Neenan exemplified a kind of grace in academic leadership that I think a number of us have always tried to imitate, knowing that we'd never quite get there, but what a good person could do in one of these offices in driving an institution forward.
Yeah, like you, I feel so fortunate to have worked alongside Father Neenan and just to have known him. And we could probably do a whole hour on Father Neenan, and maybe we'll reserve that for a future conversation. David, you mentioned you teach in the core, and in introducing you, I touched on the core renewal. Why did the core need to be renewed?
It's a great question. The core, and one of the things I'm most proud of at Boston College, is that it's rooted in a five-century tradition of Jesuit Catholic higher education. The Ratio Studiorum of the late 16th century set a blueprint that Jesuit high schools, but especially colleges and universities, have followed for the better part of half a millennium. At the same time, I think the genius of Jesuit higher education is always to be open to what the spirit of a particular age calls for and demands of our faculty and of our students, and mixing that kind of commitment to a longer tradition and a kind of animating openness to the current moment is what I think has served Boston College and other Jesuit schools so well over the years. And when I arrived in 1998, 22 years ago, I started asking questions in the history department, kind of getting back to my earlier answer, about when do we get to start talking about core revision, core kind of rethinking. At that point, we were eight years out from the previous version, which led to the 1991 core, which some on the line would have experienced as students back in the 90s and 2000s. And over that next decade, it took until I became dean in 2008, and really to get to 2012, when working with Mary Crane, the director of the Institute for the Liberal Arts, and Dean Boynton over in the Carroll School, that we were able to kind of expand a broader faculty and community conversation about what are our deepest hopes for our students in the core? Why do we have such an extensive footprint for the core, 35% or so of the 120 credit hours that students take here? Why are we investing so much in the core, and how can we make sure that the core lives up to our hopes for the institution, and especially for the young people here? And so probably the academic administrative experience I most treasure was that several years long conversation from 2012 to 2015, as you mentioned, where we brought together a wide range of stakeholders and led to what is now 5 years of the core renewal, focused not just on the complex problem and enduring questions, new designs for first year courses, but a range of innovations in departments across the university, much more collaboration, much more interdisciplinarity, and a great deal more kind of local thinking about what it is that we're trying to achieve for our students and how can we improve those local cores to deliver on that. Mm-hmm.
So David, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, when I hear that term, you know, that phrase that describes the one part of the core renewal, complex problems and enduring questions, it sure feels like we're living in a time right now where every day brings a new complex problem and a reminder of an enduring question. Let me think about it this way. If 10 years from now, someone were designing one of those core renewal classes to focus on COVID and everything we're going through, how would the core approach engaging students in something like we're going through today? Can you give us a flavor of the kinds of things we're doing with these core renewal classes through the lens of how current issues might be leveraged for the purpose of teaching students and helping to form them?
Great question. And I've probably used the line mother of all complex problems way too often in emails to deans and faculty colleagues over the last few weeks. I would certainly hope in the year 2030 that we'd see such courses available for our students. My hope is that we see the courses coming online in fall 2020 and spring 2021, that faculty will engage in really imaginative and rigorous ways around the fundamental questions that are before us. The Global Public Health and Common Good Initiative, one of the undergraduate cross-school minors that we've launched in the last year, is already engaging with some of these questions, bringing together scientists, but also social scientists, policymakers, law school professors to think about the various humanistic, scientific, policy dimensions of the challenges of this moment. I think that there are courses that can be designed over this next year to think about the implications of, take one question, contact tracing in a free society. What does it look like to bring contact tracing to a free university like Boston College in a complex cosmopolitan city like Boston Chestnut Hill at some point in the early part of this coming decade? The questions are all around us. I think the complex problems we always had in mind as a lively, flexible model that could adapt to the challenges of a given moment, I think the courses that have in some ways even more pleased us in the way in which they've been deployed and imagined by our faculty colleagues are the enduring questions, which is to take some of the fundamental questions of the Jesuit tradition that we're trying to teach and pass on to our students, and to take those and grapple with the fundamental questions of our age. I've taught a couple of enduring questions courses over the last few years, but we have colleagues across campus coming from the medical humanities, from the professional schools, from a host of different disciplines, asking about our obligations to our fellow man. How do we think about questions of justice, about love and citizenship, of belonging, some of the fundamental values that underscore a Boston College Jesuit education, and how do they engage with, how do they help us make sense of and feel our way forward through this crisis, which I'd venture to say none of us on the call have had any experience dealing with. This is academic leadership, faculty teaching, parenting, all of us living lives as citizens without a playbook. What do we have available to us? And this is where the value of a higher education, especially the distinctive life-giving higher education that Boston College as a Jesuit Catholic institution is committed to, I think gives us the outlines of a set of ways of thinking, of imagining, of working together through this current moment, and I hope over these next few years.
And David, that prompts me to think about asking you about the student experience in the classroom. You mentioned that you're still teaching, you've been teaching in the core, in the past few years. How is teaching today at BC different compared to in the 90s, and maybe through the lens of what do you notice in the students at BC today? What is it that still surprises you when you sort of walk into a classroom of BC students, and what are the things that you would want to share with alumni in particular about the kinds of students we're bringing to BC and what they're bringing to the table?
Great question, and the thing that I think keeps you and me and all of us on staff, faculty, administration so energized by the work here, with the great blessing of our professional careers, is to work with the undergraduates and graduate students who come to Boston College. So I would say 22 years on, the students here at Boston College are as strong, if not stronger, than ever. Grant Goslin, John Mahoney, the teams in admissions and enrollment management do great work. We're blessed to draw students from around the country and around the world. The mix of their interests and desires give life to this university. I think that an interest in some of the applied realms would be one of the striking elements of students today versus when I arrived on campus in 1998. And that applies to not just STEM fields, but the public health as one instance, policy elements within economics, sociology, political science, the ways in which complex problems courses are trying to get students the academic rigor to think about challenging contemporary problems, but also to think about some of the policy possibilities of their work while here at Boston College and beyond. I think that there are a wide range of ways in which our students are constantly challenging us to think about how the curriculum that we are passing down to them can speak more powerfully to the world that they're living in. And I think this current coronavirus COVID-19 moment is forcing all of us to think even more imaginatively here. I know a number of you were on a call a couple of weeks ago with Father Jack Butler, one of our favorite kind of partners in crime here on campus, and nudging this institution forward and really serving the needs of our students and responding to the needs of the time. And one of the key words that Jack, like so many other Jesuits that I've come to treasure as friends, emphasize is the power, in some ways, the transcendent power of the imagination. And I think that the best of our faculty this semester, both in the work they've done over the last 6 weeks, but as we plan for what's coming in the 2021 academic year, are harnessing their imaginations individually, but also collectively, to think about this new world. Whatever we're facing coming in the fall is going to be different from any other fall we faced before, because the virus will still be with us. But how do we ensure that the teaching and learning that's going on in our classrooms between faculty and students is shaped by our abiding commitments, our interest in formative education, our thoughts about integrating students' intellectual, social, spiritual lives in a larger whole? It's a work that continues, that in some ways is more urgent than ever right now, but that turn to the imagination and thinking about kind of collectively how do we work together has been, I think, one of the great blessings of the last few weeks as we've worked together to get through the crisis of spring 2020. And now as we start to look ahead to the continuing crisis of the next year, that turn to what are we doing, what do we value most, and how do we best serve our students serves us well.
So let's talk about that. You just touched on it, the shift and the adapting that had to take place with the shift to remote learning. I think about the work that you and the deans do. It took you 3 years to plan a major shift in the core renewal, and you probably had 3 weeks to figure out how to shift everyone from physical classrooms to learning in their, out of their homes. Talk a little bit about the process of that, but I think we'd probably love to hear a little bit about what you're noticing. You just mentioned briefly that you've been inspired by what you're seeing. Can you share a little bit more about how it went and how it's going?
Sure. Again, I was paying daily attention through especially the latter half of January and February as these world events were starting to pick up pace and studying what was going on in other parts of the world. When a member of the executive committee of the Board of Trustees asked me in early February what was keeping me up at night that morning, went home kicking myself why I used this example, but it was the moment where the doctor, I should know his name, in Wuhan had passed away late that Thursday night into Friday morning. And that was one of those moments that was jarring. And so we began in February to pull together both the deans and select academic leaders and partners on campus to develop and be ready to activate our scenario plans, our emergency response plans over the course of the month of February, not knowing at all how March and now April were going to turn out. Our spring break, the first week of March, which is always a little bit earlier than most of our peers, was both a little bit of bad luck since we had students traveling around the country, learned just how much of a bunch of globetrotters our undergraduates were in the course of that early March window, but also a bit of a blessing in that we had more than a week there to let faculty know that we needed to prepare for anything that could come our way in the second half of the semester. We got back, actually before everyone returned on the Friday afternoon in the first week of March, that afternoon as the Board of Trustees wrapped up its meeting, I received an email as I was walking across campus that the University of Washington in Seattle was the first national institution that had moved all their classes online for the rest of their winter term, not for the whole spring. But then between that Friday afternoon and the following Friday afternoon when we announced our decision, things moved more quickly than at any time in my academic career and I think in all of our lives. Again, the reflections on that moment are still being written, processed. I think BC Magazine next month will feature some of those here on campus. We made the decision and we moved quickly to have all of our classes go remote starting on the morning of March 19th. That gave us time both to get students home without the pressure of trying to stay online with classes and also give faculty a few more days to adapt to what was coming. The classes that I was probably most worried about at that point in time were the more experiential classes, lab sciences in particular, some of our studio art courses, service learning classes. While there's been unevenness on our campus and across all of higher education in terms of the delivery of these classes, I will admit that I've been pleasantly surprised by the imagination and the commitment of so many of my faculty colleagues in designing experiences. Two colleagues in the physics department, the laboratory experiences they put together, which I've kind of continued sampling over the last 6 weeks, just to get a sense of how they're bringing our science, our STEM students along, the ways in which the perspectives faculty and Pulse faculty have been meeting regularly to think about, okay, in the absence of our regular on-campus meetings, and especially for Pulse, those in-service opportunities around the Boston area, how can we help our students grapple with this moment where the fundamental questions that have always stood at the heart of Pulse and Perspectives are more pressing for faculty and students than at any time in the 4 or 5 decades of those programs' histories? It's been wonderful to see. Kay Schlossman, one of my veteran colleagues from the political science department who joined our faculty in 1974, has invited me in for a senior toast for her senior seminar this afternoon. So when I get off the line here, I'll be zooming over to Professor Schlossman's end of semester seminar where I'll raise a glass of sparkling water here to celebrate the graduates in the class of 2020. The ways in which some of our centers, I'm thinking of the Corcoran Center for Real Estate and Urban Action and what Neil McCullough is doing, Jerry Doyle and Kelsey Clinton over in the Shea Center for Entrepreneurship. I believe Jerry might even be on the line with us today, just doing unbelievable work, bringing more vibrant communities of BC students and friends of the university together. Some of the best attended events our centers and related academic programs have ever had have come through the virtual space this semester. So, again, some heartening stories, some evidence of what we need to improve as we get ready for the fall, but a lot of encouraging evidence of a community rallying around each other and supporting colleagues who weren't up to speed at the beginning of the semester, folks who had never been on a Zoom call before the semester and are now living their lives in this format. One last point before we can, I'll turn it back to you, Jim. One of the most interesting learnings is in the difference between synchronous and asynchronous instruction. And for those of you who are not attuned to all the inside lingo of contemporary higher ed or education more generally, synchronous means what Jim and I are doing right now with all of you on the line. You're hearing a conversation in real time and everybody is engaging. Asynchronous is when we would record this and post it online for people to have the benefit at a later date. And many lectures have been done in online forms over the years asynchronously. Most of the data before this semester had suggested that student learning outcomes were often better in the asynchronous form than necessarily in synchronous. Here on campus, as we've reflected with our students, with faculty, with deans, with some parents who are out there on the line today, and here I'll reference my leadership of the New England Commission on Higher Education, our regional accrediting group, where I spent the last 2 years chairing that group, and I spent Thursday, Friday last week in full day NECHI Zoom sessions, our first ever virtual meetings as a body, with many of the presidents of the leading institutions in New England, including MIT's president. And Raphael Reif, who's one of the world's leaders in higher ed, was grappling with exactly that same point, where he thought as a bedrock principle that asynchronous always trumped synchronous. But both of us, and I think folks around the world, are grappling with the fact that actually there's a good deal of evidence coming in this semester that there's something special, especially in a residential community like Boston College, where we are scattered around the world right now, to those synchronous connections. Even when students are 6, 8, 12 hours removed in terms of time zones, there's a hunger for connection, a hunger for being linked in the course material that we need to figure out how to respond to. If we need to do more of this in future semesters, please God, in some future pandemic that might fall us, that we would need to think about synchronous instruction in somewhat different ways than we might have back in early March when we were making this shift.
David, that's really encouraging to hear, and I'm sure encouraging to a lot of folks, and even just to know that in places where, you know, I think you're right, there are a lot of places where it's going very well, where the remote teaching is going very well, I'm noticing just how hard the faculty are trying. And in even places where it's not every situation is ideal, to just know that the effort is there. As a parent, I'll say I'm grateful for your leadership and the work of the faculty on this front. I'm noticing that some of the questions that are coming in are pivoting to some of the new directions that you and the faculty are taking us in academically. A couple of people have asked about the Schiller Institute, which, you know, we launched a few years ago, thanks to a wonderful gift from the Schiller family. You know, there's a hole in the ground on middle campus now where a new building is going to go. We hired our first director of the Schiller Institute. We announced this human-centered engineering program. Tell everyone a little bit about what's going on here. And you know, for people who, you know, maybe don't immediately think of BC as a school that is in this, for which this sort of work is in our sweet spot, what is BC going for in focusing on engineering and science through these programs?
And this is one where I could go straight until evening and maybe beyond. So cut me off when I've gone on too much, because it's the thing in some ways that I'm most excited about at the moment. As I said, core renewal was the thing that I'm most proud of at this point. In some ways, as you rehearsed my biography before I jumped on the call earlier, I was playing to type when I was involved in helping design and staff up the Humanities Center. The history guy here makes sense that the Humanities Building, Stokes Hall, is one of the things that I was involved in. In some ways, I'm playing against type with the whole Schiller Initiative, and it's, again, something that has been endlessly fascinating for me, a little bit of Nixon in China, I guess, but I think the right way for Boston College to respond to this moment. The most basic level, I couldn't be more proud of the fact that we rolled out a year ago a program in global public health and the common good, given the fact that we are spending our lives looking at the various models produced by the University of Washington, the CDC, by public health entities around the world, that our students and our faculty had been moving ahead of us and trying to hold together this attempt to engage the serious science and academic work with this more policy applied orientation has given life to the Global Public Health Initiative within the Schiller Institute that Phil Landrigan, a BC grad, has been helping to lead. That's just one small instance of how the Schiller Institute, with funding provided by Board of Trustee member and class of 1982 graduate Phil Schiller and his wife Kim Schiller, has provided for us. Tom Childs, our Vice Provost for Research and longtime chair of the Biology Department, and I have worked closely, especially along with Greg Kalscher, the Jesuit Dean of the Morrissey College of Arts and Sciences, to put together plans over the last 5 years that are resulting in a building which is going up. The steel continues to rise on the former site of Cushing Hall, the old home of the nursing school on campus, with an expected completion date in November, December of 2021 for the new building that will house the Schiller Institute. What is the Schiller Institute going to be? It is going to be a cross-disciplinary home for teaching and research that brings together scholars from around the campus and beyond to focus on some particularly pressing questions related to health, energy, and the environment, very much responsive to the great crisis of this moment in time, but also to think about new possibilities for curriculum. So the program that has grabbed the most of our focus over these last several years, and where we're beginning to do hiring even as I speak, is engineering, a program that Boston College has never had, and we are intending to bring in the first cohort of undergraduate human-centered engineering BS students in the fall of 2021. Those students would have been touring our campus in the spring of 2020. As the father of a high school junior who is kind of in the no man's land of no SATs, no actual tours of campuses, at least for the time being, we're navigating this world just like all those other students. But Grant Goslin, John Mahoney, our partners Jack Dunn in University Communications have put together a wonderful website, which I'd encourage all of you to go look at for more information about how we're going to roll this out. It'll start with a small cohort of 25 students to begin, but then roll out to at least 50 in future years, beginning in the fall of 2022. And we'll try, just as with public health, as what we're doing across all Schiller Institute programs, to engage the great questions of this age that require technological expertise, competence in a range of fields, the pandemic of the moment, which requires world-class expertise in areas of health and related disciplines, but to bring a Boston College orientation to engaging in those areas, to make sure that our humanists, our ethicists in particular, are there constantly engaging with our students and faculty. Just because we can develop a technology does not necessarily mean that we should be pursuing those technologies. As we've engaged with leaders at MIT, at Olin, at schools around the country, to think about how can we step into the engineering space, but not just to replicate what others have done, but to bring a distinctive and powerful Boston College voice to engineering education? We've been gratified by the ways in which people talk about the need for the humanistic, ethical, rigorous approach that Boston College has long brought to bear. Jim, you've heard me talk about this over the last 5 years or so as I've talked to other communities of friends of Boston College, about the genius of those leaders of the university around three quarters of a century ago, who started at that time at a school with very limited operations to think about what a College of Business Administration could look like. Why Boston College, rooted in that ratio studiorum and basically delivering a philosophy major to every undergraduate back in the early 20th century, should think about accounting, finance, other business fields. And as a result, BC was especially well positioned to have our alumni rise into leadership positions in the second half of the 20th century and bring that distinctive Boston College form of leadership, very often a form of servant leadership, to their fields and professions. And in an age where we are all blessed by the technologies, talking to my elderly parents with my sisters every night on a Zoom for I think 5 weeks running right now, I can speak all day about the blessings of technology. We also know of the challenges, especially the ethical and dehumanizing challenges of technology in this age. And one of my hopes is that, as you were talking about the courses that we might offer in 2030, I hope that those who look back on our moment of BC leadership in not just 10, but 25, 50 years from now, will look back and say that BC, by moving in the Schiller direction, by investing in computer science, engineering, public health, and related fields, we were responding to the needs of the moment. But again, not slavishly imitating everybody else, but creatively bringing the BC approach to these fields in desperate need of our leadership.
David, one quick follow-up on this. I'm just looking at questions that are coming in. We have a number of parents with us of current undergraduates and some parents of prospective undergraduates on the chat today joining us on the webinar. And a couple of them have asked if, you know, does Schiller remain on track in terms of its planned timeline? And I know none of us have crystal balls, but when you look at where we're going for parents whose kids maybe came to BC or considering BC because of their excitement around everything you just described, you know, what's the timeline look like? And do you have reason to believe that we'll stay on that timeline?
I am an optimist by nature, but I think there's a lot of evidence that supports my innate optimism on this. First of all, on my early morning walk around campus, the steelworkers of Boston are continuing with that tower crane to put up the building. I think they're up to the third story of the new structure, and that's moving well. The head of the firm that is building the facility that will house Schiller is confident that we will have the building ready to open in the 21-22 academic year. We hope by the end of that fall semester. We are continuing to hire. We are holding back on most hiring for the university across fields, including faculty at this point, but we have made hiring for the Schiller program, especially for engineering, a priority at this moment so that we actually have engineers. We've hired the first two engineering faculty in the last couple of months, and we anticipate hiring a few more over the course of these next few months. That way it's critical for the successful launching of that program in the fall of 21 and 22. We've been thrilled to see the level of candidates who've been coming in and the growing interest in the field here. What it's going to look like over the next year, there's a lot of virtual recruitment that we're doing across the board for the class of 2025. We're turning the switch there for the prospective engineers here. We're going to be able to deliver on that, where exactly everything's going to take place for those first courses offered in the fall of 2021. I don't have the strongest crystal ball at this point, but I am very confident that we will have engineering faculty on campus and the first undergraduate BS students in fall of 21. Critical because we can't get full ABET accreditation for our undergraduate engineering program until we've graduated the first class. So that would come in the 25-26 academic year after graduating that first cohort, we anticipate in May of 2025.
David, another question that pivots off your comments. Someone asked, what is the Shea Center for Entrepreneurship exactly? Is entrepreneurship now a major at BC?
The Shea Center, for those of you who don't know about it, is an aspect of contemporary BC that I'd very much urge you to look up. Do a quick Google search. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by what's cropped up, what's arisen on campus over the last 5 years or so. Thanks to a visionary and very generous gift from the Shea family out on the West Coast, largely in honor of their deceased patriarch, Edmund Shea. The Shea family has provided remarkable support for a center that is housed within the Carroll School of Management, but has done extraordinary work connecting with all 8 colleges and schools on campus and with members of the extended BC family around the world. It's been thrilling to see what Jerry Doyle and his team have been able to do over the last few years, but especially over the last 6 weeks. Jack Dunn in University Communications has some interesting stories on this, so you should be able to find some features that are already out there and others coming in the next few weeks. The hope is to foreground the work that Boston College students and alumni have done over the years in the innovation and entrepreneurship space, both in for-profit and not-for-profit settings, in the Boston Innovation Zone, on the West Coast, around the globe. And Shea has become a hub here on campus for bringing together lively conversations about how does entrepreneurship not reflect in some ways a new direction for BC, but in some ways connecting very powerfully with the entrepreneurial genius of St. Ignatius and the first Jesuits. If you look across 500 years, if you look at Father Neenan, if you look at many of the best BC alums, leaders, community members over the years, there's been a kind of longing for something better, a kind of imagination for new possibilities that has driven this institution forward at our best moments. And it's been great to see how the Shea Center has taken advantage of that. And to get back to your particular question, Jim, we were very mindful that while Shea could have a wonderful home with Dean Boynton and all our good friends over in Fulton Hall, given that the new building that will house Schiller is right next door, just to the east on the old Cushing Hall site in the science district between Merkert and Higgins, but also a little bit of a node connecting all sorts of stakeholders, we decided to put the Shea Center in pretty much the prime real estate in the new building. You'll walk off just a little into the building off the green, just to the south of the St. Ignatius statue in front of Higgins Hall, walk in, and while there'll be a buzz of activity, we'll have 9 classrooms, we'll have the computer science department, we'll have labs upstairs, engineering, teaching spaces down the hall, maker spaces. I could talk all day about what's in there. The first thing that one will encounter when you walk into the building is the Shea Center to communicate just how central that program is and how it's been able to forge really interesting connections between different communities on campus over the last few years.
Thanks, David. One more question on academics that's reflective of a lot of questions that have come in, and then I want to turn to a couple of new topics that are representing being people are asking questions about. A number of folks wrote, one person wrote that she's very aware of the important role BC plays in, you know, educating and training students who are going on to be on the front lines of, you know, caring for others who are disadvantaged or who are in need of care. And she references specifically the School of Nursing, the School of Education and Human Development, our School of Social Work. And a number of folks have asked about those different schools in different ways. So I'm just going to ask you in general, can you talk a little bit about the important role that BC plays by having programs in nursing, education, human development, social work, and what excites you about the work that you're seeing that the deans are undertaking in those schools, and in particular about the work that you're seeing from the students there?
Great question, Jim. And appropriate to a Jesuit institution, I think we take our mission as seriously, if not more so, than any of my good friends who serve as provosts at peer universities around the country. We are constantly thinking about what makes BC a distinctive kind of university for our students and for the world we hope those students will eventually go on and lead. And when you think of mission and our academic programs, nowhere is it more powerfully felt and lived out than in the School of Social Work and the Lynch School of Education and Human Development. And here, I think, I'll spend most of my answer talking about the Cannell School of Nursing and the work that Dean Gennaro and her faculty and students have been doing. Again, this has been a time where we've all been overwhelmed with what comes into our email boxes, the communications we've been receiving, but some of the emails that I've been receiving, but especially that Dean Gennaro has been sharing with me from recent alums who are on the front lines around the country, especially in New York City and the New York City area, in other parts of the world, doing the work that we couldn't be more proud of, just taking their Boston College education and trying to serve a world that is always in need, but never more desperately in need of what our graduates can do. Again, you don't want me to get choked up in the course of this call, but just thinking about what our graduates, recent and longstanding, have been able to do, and the leadership, but especially that servant leadership that they brought to bear in healthcare settings and in a host of different ways around the world. Again, as I talked earlier, one of the particular challenges for us is experiential education. How do you do that in a virtual age? We can do these Zoom beacon leadership conversations a little more easily than kind of training students to engage with patients. Our simulation labs in the new space in Maloney Hall have opened up some possibilities even earlier in the semester. We're working with partners from around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to create different pathways for our students forward. But it's been wonderful to see that both those recent alums, but I should also note the dozen or so of our Cannell School faculty who are, and even more at this point, who've been working in healthcare settings around the Boston area, working in this peak phase of the coronavirus here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to provide leadership. We look forward over the summer to additional opportunities to get students and faculty into those settings and provide even greater care. But I don't think there's been a more powerful example of the ways in which Boston College has responded to the needs of this particular moment than what we've been seeing over in the Cannell School and what faculty, staff, and students are doing on it an hourly basis these days.
David, I wish we had time to go more deeply into a lot of these topics, and maybe this will provide some opportunities for us for future, you know, Beacon Leadership Conversation partners, because there's a lot that I think that I can tell by the comments that are coming in, there's a hunger for more information on everything you're touching on. There are two topics that I think have come from so many people that we're just going to have to touch on them in the time we have left, and I want to be sure that we get to them. And they're a little bit related, but one is, you know, a lot of people are asking about admissions, the move to early decision, how that went, what was the thinking behind it. Some people are asking about, related to admissions, financial aid, concerns you might have about affordability and how BC is prepared to sort of respond to increased financial need at a time like this. And then the other question that's on many people's minds is, how is BC, how are you, how is our academic leadership thinking about the fall, in terms of various scenarios? Some people I'll come back to that in a second. So why don't we start with admissions and financial aid? And could you just, in a few minutes, just touch on early decision in what the outlook looks like in terms of students who come to us from situations where they're going to need assistance to be able to afford Boston College.
Sure. I would start this by saying that not knowing it at the time, but two of the best decisions that clusters of decisions that I've made in my 6 years as provost. First was launching the Center for Teaching Excellence and the Centers for Teach and the Center for Digital Innovation and Learning over the last few years, which positioned us well for the transition to remote instruction this semester. The other was a little over a year ago, working with Father Lay and John Mahoney and Grant Goslin to decide that we should move to early decision one and two this year after decades of being an early action school. Won't go into all the thinking behind it because I'm mindful of the time and your other questions, but it went very well. We were pleased with the number and especially quality of the ED1 and ED2 applicants. We aim for a class of 22 to 2300. We filled up more than 1,000 of our seats in the entering class of 2024 by early February with the ED2 process. That means that we're just about at 2,000 overall deposits at this point, tracking towards the end of this week for that target of a entering class of 22 or 2300. A lot of good news in the entering class. Also some unpredictability. One of the assumptions I've had over the last 6 weeks is that we would see a kind of geographic impetus to decision making, that generally speaking, students who are further away would be less likely to come to BC, those closer at home would be more likely. That is not the case. In international enrollments, a little bit up, California slightly down, Massachusetts a little bit down, Connecticut and New York up. Texas up for whatever reason, Florida down. Again, we won't know for sure until we get into early May and can put that all together, but there's a lot of curious noise in the system this year that we're grappling with, but again, gratified by the interest in Boston College, the wisdom of going with early decision, and looking forward to welcoming those students both virtually through an online orientation experience in June and July, but we hope in person later in calendar 2021. That'll get to your other question in a moment. Let me turn now to financial aid. And here I should remark that you mentioned that I took over the job in 2008 as dean of what was then the College of Arts and Sciences. I took over a week after Lehman Brothers collapse, and it was a time of free fall for the world economy. And so my trial by fire as an academic administrator was in a world where uncertainty was the rule. I never thought I would be in academic administration when I would be longing for the relative certainty and comfort of 2008, 2009 because of the vastness of the uncertainty we're facing right now. And much of that relates to financial aid. We're seeing particular needs with students in the entering class of 2024. We expect over the next couple of months to see substantial need for returning students in the classes of 21, 22, 23. That's before we're even talking about graduate and professional students and some of their needs. So however we are able to move forward with the 2021 academic year, clearly there will be substantial, and I would say probably historic demands on our financial aid budget. One of the things I'm most proud of being an academic administrator at Boston College is our enduring commitment to generous financial aid, to being one of a few, 19 at this point, national universities who are need blind when it comes to financial aid and commit to meeting the full demonstrated need of admitted students. That commitment is going to be tested perhaps more than ever over the next year.
David, I don't know if that was you or me, but can you hear me?
It was me, my 10 minutes to the hour mark. Sorry for that, but I can jump in now. Do you want me to just jump into your other question, which you
framed? So the fall, and I think I'll ask it one particular way because I thought this was a good question. One person observed that one of the reasons why remote learning has probably gone well or better than we might have hoped this semester, if not perfectly, is that these are students who started in physical classrooms and then transitioned remotely. So one specific question is, could you envision a scenario where we start online in the fall fresh? And do you have any, and then the other questions were just generally about what's your observations and sense of scenarios for how we're going to look at the fall in terms of reopening BC?
That is the question of this moment for all of us in higher ed and for whatever field you're in. How do we collectively begin moving back to a more normal state of affairs, recognizing that we're going to be in this kind of in-between phase for some period of months, if not semesters, until certainly a vaccine, best case, or certainly more effective therapeutics are in place. So what I would have thought was in the realm of possibility a couple of months ago, I think I've learned to greatly expand my imagination for what's possible on a campus, and also for a deeper understanding of the resilience of this institution and of higher ed more generally. Before getting to the particulars of Boston College, I should say that across the country, and partly this is occasioned by my leadership of the Regional Accrediting Commission, for higher ed more generally, I would second some of the sentiments in the President of Brown, Christina Paxson's communication that came out in the New York Times this week, talking about how critical it is for higher ed to come back to something approaching normal in the next academic year. The alternative is worrying to think about for other institutions. I think BC is better positioned than many of our peers, but it would be worrying for higher ed as a whole if one had to go through an entire semester, or much less an entire year, online. Turning to Boston College, I think that the work we're doing right now, beginning now, but picking up in earnest once we call and put a rest to the teaching of the spring semester late in Thursday, April 30th, which is the final day of our 27 days of remote teaching and learning. I think the months of May, June, and July will be occupied with planning. We don't have a firm set date for when we'll make an announcement about what we're going to be doing in the fall, but certainly it's not going to be an earlier mid-August announcement. We're going to have to get out to family members, especially of current students, much sooner as we play things out. Of course, things are going to rapidly change, I would imagine, over the course of the month of May and into June. So sometime as we move into June, perhaps even into early July, I think we'll have greater clarity. I think we certainly have to place front and center in all of our thinking the safety of our community, the safety of our students, of our faculty, and our staff as we're moving towards thinking about delivering a high-quality Boston College education to those students who are enrolled for the 2021 academic year. We have to design and develop plans that are much more flexible, much more adaptable, much more resilient. If we're able to start classes on August 31st, I hope here in Chestnut Hill, those classes, I don't think we're going to have the luxury, if we would need to, of saying we're going to hold off for a week while everybody shifts to online instruction. Right now, we've got 4 months plus before we'd have to start teaching if August 31st is the start date, as the academic calendar currently suggests. All of us, and we'll be talking with deans, department chairs, faculty across the university in coming weeks, need to continue thinking about what are the courses we're offering in the fall semester? How do we deliver those in a range of modalities? How do we account for the fact that some faculty, because of their age in some cases, because of pre-existing health conditions, might not be able to deliver instruction in a Boston College classroom on August 31st? How can we account for the fact that some number of our undergraduate or graduate students from international locations might be caught up in a delayed, if not entirely frozen, immigration system that is preventing folks from getting visas to come study in the country in late summer? There are all sorts of uncertainties which lead to an unsatisfying set of answers from me at this moment. What I can promise is academic leadership, working closely with our partners like Jim, vice presidents, the executive vice president, financial vice president, partners across the university, are spending every day, every weekend, all our times modeling different scenarios, looking ahead to the next academic year with a fervent hope that we are able to conduct in-class, on-campus instruction for 2 15-week semesters in the 2021 academic year. We'll know far better later in the spring and early in the summer what is going to be possible, and we'll promise to communicate with the members of the community when we're in a position to make those kinds of announcements, recognizing finally, before turning it back to Jim, that some of these decisions are going to be shaped by and constrained by decisions made by municipal, state, and federal leadership in coming weeks.
And David, one person and a couple of people have asked this, and a lot of people, I want to just sort of say this to you, have been expressing their gratitude for your leadership and the time you've taken. And let me thank you now as we go into our last couple of questions. But one person wrote, "I'm an alum, graduate of the 90s, parent of young kids. I'm so proud of BC and the work it's doing. What can we do as alumni to help?"
I think being there for each other. I mean, just this kind of connection, conversation. It, I've remarked on this with my basically daily Zoom meetings with deans for the last 6 weeks, our conversations with faculty across the campus. While we're distant, there's an intensity, an intimacy, a closeness that this crisis has brought on that is unlike anything in Boston College's history. I'll head out in a little while for my midday walk across campus, and there's a bittersweet quality to the kind of spring, if it ever comes, arriving here on campus and nobody to enjoy it with. And yet I'm in constant conversation with alums, former students, friends of the university, and that kind of connection and engagement is what's going to get us through this, coming out stronger than ever before. If you look back, we were founded in the darkest year of the American Civil War, 1863. The wrenching transformations of World War II brought about the greatest generation of Boston College alums. We almost collapsed coming out of the campus turmoil and societal upheavals of the 1960s. And yet, 1972, we come on, coming out of that crisis moment, thinking individually but collectively about how this moment of crisis is going to propel Boston College to that next great moment in our institution's history. The outlines of what that looked like aren't entirely clear now. Thinking about how we can help classmates in need, reaching out, again, Zoom calls, hangouts with friends of ours, thinking about ways in which local chapters might be helping, thinking about virtual send-offs, responding to those students who are thinking about BC. As I said, May 1st is the deposit deadline. If you can nudge a few prospective students across that finish line, this provost would be eternally thankful. Thinking about stepping up some support. I won't say what I'm doing for BC, but for my various alma maters, I've certainly stepped up some of my financial support in recent weeks because I know just how difficult a time this is, paying forward the generosity that those schools provided to me in a time of need when I was an aid kid back in the 80s. I've always thought that that's important as a university college citizen, but I'd say never more important than at this clearly historic moment in this institution's history.
Yeah, so well said, David. And I'm going to use 2 minutes for one last question. I'm going to bring it back to Father Neenan. So many of our people on the call know that Father Neenan was famous for his Dean's List, his annual cataloging of books that he felt were worth everyone's time, that were on his bookshelf. I think this is a time when many of the people on the call are looking for distractions, sources of renewal, sources of encouragement, sources of perspective, and we turn to books for that. What would be your recommended, if you're going to put one book on Father Neenan's Dean's List this year, right now, to recommend? Anything come to mind?
Again, like I said, we could go on all afternoon about Bill and what Father Neenan meant to all of us individually and collectively. I had the great blessing when I was 6 years dean in Gasson Hall of hosting the Baccalaureate Mass in December, and his homily every year for those 6 years was, and some of you on the line probably heard it, was about Camus' The Fall. If you haven't read The Fall, this is not the book I'm plugging, but Father Neenan certainly made you want to read that, and I reread it several times in that period. In the great spirit of Father Neenan, I've gone back and I've got my copy. It took a few weeks for my independent Porter Square Books in Cambridge to get me the copy through in-person delivery, but I got it 2 weeks ago. One of the books I haven't read since junior year English in 1983 down on the Jersey Shore, but I'm reading Camus' The Plague, which is as powerful as I remember it. In the most recent, I think it's the New York Review of Books, the Turkish novelist Orhan Pamuk writes about plague novels more generally, and Pope Francis has been reflecting on an early 19th century variant of this. But going back to Camus and remembering what I thought of that when it seemed such an alien work in 1983, and now living through it in this very different moment as a middle-aged academic administrator, is at least giving me a little sustenance these days.
Wow. Thank you, David. We're at 1 o'clock, and I want to say thank you again to my conversation partner, David Quigley. To those of you who are on the call, thank you for giving us an hour of your day. I hope it was enjoyable. I hope that you will send us your suggestions for future Beacon Leadership conversation partners, and have a wonderful day, everyone. Take good care.